face. His eyes were dark-ringed, his chest rising and falling with what seemed painful effort. He nodded at his wife, and she took it for an instruction, drawing the curtains around the bed so that King and Rebus were shielded from the other patients. The man pulled the mask down so it rested against his chin.
ID, he demanded.
Rebus dug out his warrant card, and King peered at the photograph before offering an explanation.
Wouldn't put it past Ella to rope some poor sod into pretending. She thinks the drugs must have done it.
Done what? Rebus was lowering himself into a chair.
Got me imagining things.
King paused, studying his visitor.
You don't look much younger than me.
Thanks for that.
But it means you'll remember the mods? Early 60s?
I'm not sure they made it this far north. We had the music, though.
I grew up in London. Had the Lambretta and the clothes. Our wages either went on one or the other. Weekend trips, Brighton and Margate. I liked Brighton better.
King drifted off, his eyes becoming unfocused. There was a tumour in him that had grown too large to be dealt with. Rebus wondered what painkillers the doctors were giving him. He had a headache of his own. Maybe they had a few pills to spare. There was a loud wheezing from somewhere beyond the curtain. Another patient jolted into life by a coughing fit. King blinked away whatever memories he'd been replaying.
Your wife, Rebus said. When she called us, she said there was something you wanted to say.
That's what I'm doing, King retorted, sounding irritated. I'm telling you the story.
About your days as a mod.
My last time in Brighton.
You and your scooter.
And 100 others like me. It was a religion to us. Something we were going to take to the grave.
He paused.
And we hated those rockers almost as much as they hated us.
Rockers were bikers,
Rebus checked, receiving a slow nod of agreement from King.
Pitched battles on the seafront, he went on. I remember it from Quadrophenia.
Anything and everything became your weapon. I always had a blade with me, taken from my mum's cutlery drawer. But there were bottles, planks of wood, bricks.
Rebus knew now what was coming, and leaned in a little closer toward the bed.
So what happened? He prompted.
King was thoughtful for a moment, then took a hit of oxygen before saying what needed to be said.
One of them, jeans stained with oil, 3-inch turn-ups, leather jacket and t-shirt. He starts running the wrong way, gets separated from the pack. A few of us peel off and go after him. He knows he's not going to outrun us, so dives into a hotel just off the Esplanade. Far as I remember, we were laughing like it was a game. But it wasn't. Not once we cornered him in one of the storerooms off the kitchen. Fists and feet to start with. But then he's got a blade out, and so have I. And I'm faster than him. The knife, my mum's knife, was still sticking out of his chest when we ran.
King looked up at Rebus, eyes widening a little.
I left him there to die. That's why I need you to arrest me.
His eyes were filling with liquid.
Because all the years since, I've never gone a day without remembering. Waiting for your lot's knock at the door. And you never came, did you? You never came.
Back in his second-floor tenement flat, Rebus smoked a couple of cigarettes and dug out his vinyl copy of The Who's Quadrophenia. He flicked through the booklet of photos and the little short story that accompanied them. Then he lifted his phone and called D.I. Siobhan Clark. Well? She asked.
It's archaeology, he told her. Summer of 64. I'm assuming it landed on my lap because someone mistook me for old Father Time. Didn't even happen in Edinburgh.
Where then?
Brighton. Mods and rockers, blood in the nostrils and amphetamines in the blood.
He exhaled cigarette smoke.
Nearly 50 years ago in a confession from a man with days left to live. Always supposing he did it. Stuff the hospital is giving him. He could be telling us next he's Keith Moon's long-lost brother.
So what do you think?
I just wish he'd asked for a priest instead.
Worth bouncing it south? You mean to Brighton? Want me to see if I can find a CID contact for you?
Reba stubbed out the cigarette. King did give me a couple of names, guys who were there when he stabbed the victim.
The victim being?
Johnny Green. The murder was in the papers. Frightened the life out of King, and that was the end of his mod days.
And the others who were with him?
He never saw them again. Part of the deal he seems to have made with himself.
50 years he's been living with this.
Living and dying with it.
If he'd confessed at the time, he'd have served a sentence and been rid of it.
I thought it best not to bring that up with him.
He heard a sigh. I'll find you someone in Brighton, she eventually said. A burden shared and all that. He thanked her and ended the call, then slipped the first of Quadrophenia's two discs out of its sleeve and placed it on the deck. He'd never been a mod. Couldn't recall ever seeing a mod, but at one time he'd known this record well. He poured himself a malt and turned up the volume. For the first time in several months, after an unusually high spate of murders in the city of Brighton this spring, Roy Grace finally had some time to concentrate on cold case reviews, which was part of his remit in the recent merger of the Sussex and Surrey major crime branches. He had just settled at a desk in the cold case office when D.S. Norman Potting entered without knocking, as usual, his bad comb-over looking thinner than ever and reeking as normal of pipe tobacco smoke. He was holding an open notepad.
"You had an interesting call earlier this morning from a D.I. in Scotland, chief, name of Siobhan Clark. Pity is, she had an English accent. I've always fancied a bit of Scottish totty."
Grace raised his eyes. "And?"
"One of her colleagues went to see a bloke in hospital in Edinburgh, apparently terminally ill. Wanted to make a deathbed confession about killing a rocker in Brighton in the summer of 64.
1964, that far back, and he's dying? Why couldn't he keep his trap shut?
Maybe he reckons you'll avoid hell this way."
Grace shook his head. He'd never really got this religious thing about confession and forgiveness.
"Just your era, wasn't it, Norman?"
"Huh."
Potting was 55, but with his shapeless frame and flaccid face could have passed for someone a good decade older.
"I've had dealings with Edinburgh. Don't know anyone called Clark, though."
Potting looked down at his notebook.
"Colleague's name is Rebus."
"Now that name I do know. He worked the Wolfman killings in London. Thought he'd be retired by now."
"That was definitely the name she gave."
"So what else did she say?"
"The deathbed confession belongs to one James Ronald King. He was a mod back then. The bloke he killed is Johnny Green."
A phone rang at one of the three unoccupied desks in the office. Grace ignored it. The walls all around were stickered in photographs of victims of murders that had never been solved. Crime scene photographs and yellowing newspaper cuttings.
"How did he kill him?"
"Stabbed him with a kitchen knife. Says he took it with him for protection."
"A real little soldier," Grace said sarcastically. "Have you checked back to see if there's any truth in it?"
"I have, Chief," Potting said proudly. "It's one of the things D.I. Clark asked me to find out. A Johnny Earl Green died during the Mods versus Rocker clashes on May 19, 1964. It was one of the worst weekends of violence of that whole era."
Grace turned to a fresh page in his policy book and made some notes. "First thing is to get the post-mortem records on Green and a mugshot and send them up to Scotland so Mr. King can make a positive ID of his victim, if he wasn't too wasted at the time to remember."
"I've already requested them from the coroner's office, Chief," Potting responded. "I've also put a request in to the Royal Sussex County Hospital for their records at the time. He might have been brought in there if he wasn't dead at the scene."
"Good man," Roy Grace thought for a moment. "My dad was a frontline PC during that era. He used to tell me about it. How on some bank holidays back then, Brighton became a war zone."
"Perhaps you could ask him if he remembers anything about this incident,"
Good idea, but we need to find a medium first.
It took a moment for this to register. Potting stood, frowning for a moment, then said,
I'm sorry, Gov, I didn't realise.
No reason why you should. 2 days later, Norman Potting came back into the cold case office, clutching an armful of manila folders which he dumped on Roy Grace's desk, then opened the top one. It was the pathologist's report on Johnny Earl Green.
It's not right, Gov, the old sweat said. Take a look at the cause of death.
Grace studied the document carefully. The list of the man's injuries did not make good reading. Multiple skull fractures resulting in subdural and extradural hemorrhage, together with direct brain tissue injury from fragments of skull displaced into the brain. Rib fractures causing flail chest and laceration by broken ribs of the liver, spleen, and lungs. Extensive fractures of the maxilla and mandible, with hemorrhage causing direct upper airway obstruction and fatal inhalation of blood, combined with stamping injury to the trachea causing cervical vertebral dislocation. Stamping injuries to the ribs, again lacerating the major thoracic and abdominal organs. Multiple defensive injury fractures to the small bones of the hands and wrist, indicative of fetal position adopted by the victim. Traumatic testicular and scrotal rupture. Grace looked up at the detective sergeant with a frown. There's nothing here about stab wounds. This James King in Edinburgh, is certain he stabbed his victim?
I spoke to John Rebus 20 minutes ago. No question, according to him, King stabbed him in the chest with the kitchen knife. Left it in the body when he fled the scene.
A knife's unlikely to have been overlooked, even back in the day, Grace said wryly.
Agreed.
Which would indicate Johnny Green was not the victim. Or am I missing something?
No, Gov.
Potting grinned and opened another folder.
I got this from the hospital. We're lucky. One more year and the records would have been destroyed. Saturday, May 19, 1964, they treated a stab assault casualty. Sabatier bread knife still in his chest. Name of Ollie Starr. He was an art student and member of an Essex biker gang. The blade damaged his spinal cord and he was transferred to the spinal injuries unit at Stoke Mandeville Hospital up in Bucks.
Did the records say what happened to him?
No, but I have the name of the officer who attended the scene and accompanied him to the county hospital. P.C. Jim Hopper.
Grace did some quick mental arithmetic. It was now 2013, 49 years ago. Many police officers started in their teens. This P.C. Hopper, he might still be around, Norman. He'd be in his 60s or perhaps 70s. If you contact Sandra Leader, who runs the retired Brighton and Hove Police Officers Association, or David Rowland, who runs the local branch of NAPO, they might know his whereabouts. NAPO was the National Association of Retired Police Officers.
I already have, and Gov, I think you're going to be very interested in this. P.C. Hopper retired as an inspector, but is still with us. What's more, he's kept in touch with Ollie Starr. The man lives right here in Brighton, apparently, and is mightily pissed off that his assailant has never been brought to justice.
Did he give you an address?
He's getting it. He also invited us to a reunion.
Grace narrowed his eyes. Reunion?
The retired officers of Brighton and Hove. It's this Saturday at the Sportsman's Pub at Withdean Stadium.
From what I've heard tell of Rebus, he wouldn't say no to a drink. Potting perked up.
Reckon D.I. Clark might be tempted too?
She might. Grace studied his calendar. It was Wednesday. The rest of this week, including the weekend, was clear. He'd promised to spend time with his beloved Cleo and their baby Noah. If this could be cleared up on Saturday, he'd have all day Sunday. Then again, how would Rebus and Clark feel about working a weekend? Give me their number in Edinburgh, he said. At 10:30 a.m. Saturday morning, after collecting John Rebus and Siobhan Clark from an early Gatwick flight, Grace and Potting drove them to Brighton, with just one detour so they could sightsee the beach and pavilion.
been here before?
Potting asked Clark, turning his head to study her more closely. No, she said, eyes on the scenery.
Gets busy on the weekend, Grace explained. Day trippers from London.
Just like 1964, Rebus commented.
Just like, Grace echoed, meeting the older man's eyes in the rearview mirror.
You work cold cases? Rebus asked him.
On top of my other duties, Grace confirmed.
I did that too until Siobhan here rescued me.
The way he said it made it sound as if he disliked being beholden.
Much crime in your neck of the woods?
Potting was asking Clark. Enough to keep us busy.
Stuff we get here,
but Grace broke in, cutting Potting off.
It's not a competition.
But of course it was, and always would be. And when Grace next met Rebus's gaze in the mirror, the two men shared a thin smile of acknowledgement. In a conference room at Sussex House CID HQ, coffee was made before they sat to watch a video compiled by Amy Hanna of Media Relations. She had put together a selection of clips from Saturday, May 19, 1964, accompanied by a soundtrack from the era, the Dave Clark Five, Kinks, Rolling Stones, Beatles, and others.
Nice touch, Remus commented, as The Kids Are All Right played.
With the blinds down, they watched the massed ranks of mods between the Palace and West Piers, many of them on scooters wearing slim ties, tab-collared shirts, sharp suits, and fur-collared parka jackets, wielding knives, and the rockers in studded leather jackets, some of them swinging heavy chains and other implements. The rockers looked little different to modern-day Hell's Angels, apart from the pompadour hairstyles. Battle raged. Battalions of Brighton police officers in white helmets on foot and on horseback, flailing their batons while being belted with stones and bottles. Siobhan Clark sucked air in through her mouth.
I had no idea, she said.
Oh, it was bad, Grace told her. My mum said my dad used to come home regularly with a black eye, bloodied nose, or fat lip.
Tribal, Potting added. Just two tribes at war.
Nearest we'd have up north, Rebus commented, would be the pitched battles at Celtic Rangers games.
But this was different, Grace said. And I'll tell you my theory, if you like.
Go ahead.
Grace leaned forward in his seat. They were the first generation ever in our country that didn't have to go and fight a war. They had to get their aggression out on something, including each other.
You still see that on a Saturday night? Rebus added with a slow nod. Young men sizing each other up, fueled and wanting some attention.
Stick around a few hours, Potting said, making show of checking his watch.
When the video was over, Rebus told the room that he needed a smoke.
I'll join you, Grace said.
Me too,
added Potting, pulling his pipe from his pocket. Siobhan Clark shook her head. You lads, run along. Then she aimed the remote at the DVD player, ready to watch the clips all over again. After fish and chips at the Palm Court on Brighton Pier, they headed to Withdean Stadium and entered the pub, where the reunion was in full swing.
Retired? Rebus snorted. Most of them are younger than me.
He looked around at the 100 or so faces.
Full pension after 30 years, Grace commented.
It's the same in Scotland, Clark explained. But John isn't having it.
Why not?
Grace sounded genuinely curious. Clark was watching Rebus head to the bar, Potting hot on his heels.
It's gone beyond being a job to him, she offered, if you can understand that.
Grace thought for a moment, then nodded. Completely. By the time they got to the bar, Potting was explaining to Rebus that Harvey's was the best local pint.
Just so long as it's not the sherry, Rebus joked.
Once they had their drinks, Potting led them over to the retired inspector, Jim Hopper, who had attended the badly injured Ollie Starr on that Saturday afternoon in 1964. Hopper was a giant of a man with a shaven head rising from apparently neckless shoulders, giving him the appearance of an American football player. But his eyes were sympathetic, his demeanor gentle. Potting handed him a drink. He took a sip before speaking.
I told Ollie you might be coming to speak to him. He seemed hellish relieved. Ever since that assault, his life's turned
to a bucket of turds.
You've kept in touch with him? Rebus nudged.
I have, yes, to tell the truth. I've always felt partways responsible. If we'd had more men on the ground that day, or we'd spotted him being chased.
Hopper winced at the memory.
I was with him in the ambulance. He thought he was dying, poured out his whole story to me as if I was the last friend he'd ever have.
Do you think he'd be able to identify the assailant after all this time? Clark asked quietly.
No doubt about it. Couldn't happen now, of course, with CCTV and DNA. Nobody'd get away with it.
It was half a century back, Rebus reminded Hopper. You're sure his memory's up to it?
A grim smile broke across the retired officer's face.
You need to see for yourselves.
See what?
Visit him, and you'll find out.
Is he married? Clark asked. Hopper shook his head.
Far as he's concerned, his life ended that day. Stabbed to the chest, then the cowards just walked away.
There was silence for a moment. They were in a bubble, far from the chatter and gossip around them.
Give us his address, Rebus ordered, breaking the spell.
Roy Grace had been in some shitholes in his time, and Ollie Starr's ground floor flat on the other side of the wall from the Brighton and Hove refuse tip was down there with the worst of them. It was dank, with dark mould blotches on one wall of the tiny hall. As they strode through, into the sitting room, there were empty beer bottles littering the place, an ashtray overflowing with butts, soiled clothing strewn haphazardly on the floor, and an ancient, fuzzy television screen displaying a football match. But none of the detectives looked at the football. All of them stared with puzzled faces at the pencil sketches that papered almost every inch of the otherwise bare walls. From each of them, an expressionless man stared out. He was the same man in every drawing, Grace realized, but he was aged progressively, from late teens to mid-60s. At every stage, he was portrayed with different hairstyles, with and without beard or moustache. They reminded Roy Grace of police identikit drawings.
Bloody hell,
Rebus muttered, stepping farther into the room.
It's James King, he turned to Ollie Starr.
Where did these...
My memory, Starr said flatly.
You've not seen him?
Not since the day he stuck a knife in me.
The likeness is amazing.
Meaning, you've got the bastard?
The muscles in Starr's face seemed to relax a fraction.
Never forgot his face, he continued. And I was a student at Hornsey School of Art, promising future, they said, maybe doing adverts and stuff, instead of which I've just been drawing him year after year, hoping one day I'd see him.
Siobhan Clark cleared her throat. We think the man who attacked you is critically ill in hospital.
Good.
That answers my first question. Starr's eyes narrowed.
What's that, then?
Whether you'd want to go ahead with the prosecution after all this time, she paused, against a man with not long to live.
I want to see him, Starr growled. I need to see him, face to face, the closer the better. He has to be shown what he did, ruin my life, and the only thing that kept me going was this dream.
What dream? Grace asked.
The dream of you lot coming here delivering the news.
Starr blinked back a tear.
We all have our dreams, eh?
His voice cracked a little.
But a man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for?
Grace was moved that the man had read Browning. He lived in a tip, yet clutched at beauty. How different might his life have been if...
If...
He caught John Rebus's eye, and then Siobhan Clark's, and knew they were thinking the same thing, while Potting tried to examine Clark's legs without her noticing.
We'd need to bring you to Edinburgh quickly, Rebus was saying. Could you fly up Monday?
Train might be less hassle, Starr said. Give me time to decide whether to spit in his face first or go straight for a punch.
Hospitals always made Roy Grace feel uncomfortable. Too many memories of visiting his dying father and, later, his dying mother. Late on Monday afternoon, he followed Rebus and Clark along the corridor of the Royal Infirmary. It looked new. No smells of boiled cabbage or disinfectant. Transport had been awaiting the group at Waverley Station, Clark making sure the visitors glimpsed the famous castle before they headed to the outskirts of the city. As Rebus pushed open the doors at the ward, Grace glanced back in the direction of Potting and Star. Neither man showed any emotion. "Okay," Grace checked, receiving two separate nods in reply. Rebus, however, had come to a sudden stop, Grace almost colliding with him. The bed in the corner was empty. The table next to it, bare.
"Shit,"
Rebus muttered, eyes scanning the room. Plenty of patience, but no sign of the only one that mattered.
"Can I help?"
a nurse asked, her face arranged into a professional smile.
"James King," Rebus informed her. "Looks like we're too late."
"Oh dear, yes.
How long ago did he die?"
The smile was replaced with something more quizzical.
"He's not dead," she explained. "He went into remission. It happens sometimes. And if I were the religious sort," she shrugged. "Spontaneous and inexplicable, but there you are. Mr. King's back home in the bosom of his family, happy as the proverbial Larry."
20 minutes later, Rebus knocked on the door of the bungalow on Liberton Bray. Ella King answered, then stared stonily at the small entourage outside.
"My husband's changed his mind," she blurted out. "It was the drugs he was taking. They got him hallucinating."
"Fine then," Rebus said, holding up his hands as if in surrender. "But could we come in a minute?" She didn't seem at all sure, but Rebus was already barging past her, stalking down the hall toward the living room, Grace and Clark right behind him. James King was seated in a large armchair, horse racing on the television. He was dressed in slacks and a polo shirt, a newspaper on his lap and a mug of tea by his side.
"You've heard the news," he boomed. "They're calling it a miracle, for want of any better explanation. And, as Ella explained about the drugs, I must have been rambling the time I talked to you."
"Is that a fact, sir? Well, is there any chance you could ramble your way to the front door? There's an old friend of yours waiting to see you."
King's face creased in confusion, but Rebus was gesturing for him to get up, and get up he did, shuffling toward the front door. Norman Potting stood on the path outside, hands resting against the handles of Ollie Starr's wheelchair.
"James King," Rebus said, "meet Oliver Starr."
"But we've never met. I don't know him. What's this all about?"
"You know me all right,"
Starr snarled, his whole body writhing as if a current were passing through it.
"You're bread knife still in an evidence locker in Brighton. Did your mum never ask you what happened to it?"
Grace watched King's face. It was as if the man had been slapped.
"What's going on?"
his wife asked, voice trembling. "A man did die that day," Clark explained, "but not the man your husband attacked. When he saw it reported, he jumped to conclusions."
"Is this the man who stabbed you, Mr. Starr?" Grace asked. "I'd know him anywhere," Ollie Starr replied, eyes burning into King's.
"You old fool," Ella King yelped at her husband. "I told you to leave it alone. Take it to the grave with you. Why did you have to bring it all up?"
"James Ronald King," Grace was intoning, "I have a warrant issued for your arrest. I'm arresting you on suspicion of the attempted murder of Oliver Starr. You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defense if you do not mention, when questioned, something which you later rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence. Is that clear?"
"I'm in remission," King gasped. "The rest of my life ahead of me."
"Had a good life so far, have you?"
Starr snarled.
"Better than mine, at any rate. All the years I've spent in a bloody wheelchair. No wife, no kids." "You can't do this,"
Ella King was pleading.
"He's a very sick man."
A hand was gripping her husband's arm.
Rebus shook his head. He's not ill, Mrs. King. We heard it from his own mouth.
But he is sick, Potting interjected. Takes a sick mind to shove a knife so deep into someone it breaks their spine.
So far in the past, though, Ella King persisted. Everything's different now.
Not so different, Rebus replied, looking toward Clark and Grace. Besides which, I'd say we got here just in the nick of time. Roy Grace nodded his agreement. Different cities, different cultures, different generations even. But he knew he shared one thing above all else with John Rebus. Pleasure in each and every result.
R.L. Stein versus Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child created their character, FBI agent A.X.L. Pendergast, almost by accident. Lincoln was an editor at St. Martin's Press and had just edited Doug's first nonfiction book, Dinosaurs in the Attic, a history of the American Museum of Natural History. After that experience, the two decided to write a thriller set in a museum. Doug wrote the first few chapters involving the investigation of a double murder and sent them to Lincoln for his opinion. Lincoln read the pages and had one objection. He felt the two cops on the investigation were essentially identical, so he suggested they fold both into the same character, who became Lieutenant Vincent Dugasta. But then he added, "We need a new kind of detective for the second investigator, a person who's unusual and who'll be like a fish out of water in New York City." Doug, already irritated at this criticism of his prose, responded sarcastically, "Yeah, right, you mean like an albino FBI agent from New Orleans." Silence passed for a few moments between them. Then Lincoln said, "I think that could work." Over the next 15 minutes, Special Agent Pendergast was formed like Athena from the forehead of Zeus. And the rest, they say, is history. Over the course of many books, Agent Pendergast has faced some unusual adversaries, including cannibalistic serial killers, arsonists, a murderous surgeon, a mutant assassin, and even his own mad genius brother. But never has he confronted an adversary like Slappy, the ventriloquist dummy. Slappy is one of R.L. Stein's creepiest creations. Bob is one of the best-selling authors of all time, with over 400 million books sold around the world. He is the creator of the amazing Goosebumps series of novels. Millions of kids began reading thanks to Bob's imagination. Within the Goosebumps series, Bob introduced Slappy through such memorable tales as Night of the Living Dummy, Bride of the Living Dummy, and Son of Slappy. Carved from coffin wood, when brought to life by a certain spoken phrase, Slappy is sarcastic, rude, sadistic, and threatening, with a raspy voice and enormous physical strength. He usually seeks to enslave the luckless child who brought him back to life. He's so popular that he's the model for an actual ventriloquist dummy sold by many retailers to this day. Bob tells a story of how Slappy was inspired by a 1945 anthology film called Dead of Night. One segment of the movie told the story of a terrifying and murderous ventriloquist dummy that eventually took possession of his owner's mind. Bob saw the film when he was young, and it scared the daylights out of him. Interestingly, as a child, Bob owned a Jerry Mahoney dummy of his own. Eventually, he became fascinated by the idea that something so human-looking and seemingly harmless could turn so completely evil. The idea of pairing the elegant, urbane FBI agent Pendergast against an evil dummy seemed so incongruous, so impossible, that Doug, Lincoln, and Bob were immediately captivated by the challenge. The result is a psychological thriller where both the dummy and Agent Pendergast play against form, assuming roles that familiar readers may find strange and unsettling. One thing is certain, this story is not intended for children.
Gaslighted. There was a tap, tapping sound. That was all. Was it a clock? No. It was too loud, too irregular. Was it the creaking of an old house, the ticking of a radiator? The man listened to the sound. Gradually, he became aware of certain things, or rather, the absence of things. The absence of light, of sensation, of a name. That was unusual, was it not? He was a man with no name. He had no memory. He was a tabula rasa, an empty vessel. And yet he sensed that he knew many things. This was a paradox. The ticking sound grew louder. The man struggled to understand. Sensation began to return. He was blind, hooded. His hands and feet were immobilized, not bound, but strapped. He was lying on a bed. He tried to move. The restraints were soft, comfortable, and effective. He was not hungry. He was not tired. He was neither hot nor cold. He was not frightened. He felt calm. Tap, 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 tap. He listened. A thought came into his head. If he could understand what made that sound, perhaps all else would come back. He tried to speak, and a sound emerged, the hiss of breath. The tap-tapping stopped. Silence. Then he heard a creaking sound. This he recognized. Footfalls on a wooden floor. They were growing closer. A hand grasped the hood, and he heard the sound of Velcro parting. The hood was gently removed, and he saw a face drawing toward him. He realized from the movement of air over his scalp that his own head had been shaved. He had once had hair. At least he knew that much about himself. And then the face moved into his field of view. The light was dim, but he could make out the face quite distinctly. It was a man in his 40s, wearing a gray flannel suit. The face was sharp. It had high cheekbones, an aquiline nose. Bony ridges around the eyes gave it a skull-like, asymmetric quality. His hair was ginger-colored, and he sported a thick, neatly trimmed beard. But the most startling effect was in his eyes. One was a rich hazel green, clear and deep, the pupil dilated. The other was a milky blue, opaque, dead, the pupil contracted to a tiny black point. The sight of the eyes triggered something. Something massive, a Niagara of memory, came thundering back all at once, leaving the man on the bed almost paralyzed with the crushing weight of it. He stared at the man bending over him. Diogenes, he whispered. Aloysius, the man said, his brow furrowed with concern. Thank God you're awake. Aloysius. Aloysius Pendergast. That was his name. Special Agent Aloysius Pendergast. You're dead, he said. This is a dream. No, said Diogenes, almost tenderly. You've awakened from a dream. Now, you're on the road to healing, at long last. As he said this, he leaned over and unstrapped his brother's wrists from their leather restraints. He leaned over to fluff and adjust Pendergast's pillow, smooth the sheets. You can sit up if you feel able. You've done this to me. This is one of your schemes. Come now. Please, not this again. Out of the corner of his eye, Aloysius saw movement. He turned his head. The door to his room had opened, and a woman was walking in. It was a woman he recognized instantly, Helen Esterhazy, his wife, his dead wife. He stared in horror as she approached. She reached out to take his hand, and he pulled it away. "This is a hallucination," he said. "This is very real," she said gently. "Impossible." She sat down on the edge of the bed. "We're alive, both of us. We're here to assist in your recovery." Aloysius Pendergast mutely shook his head. If this wasn't a dream, then he must be under the influence of drugs. He would not cooperate in whatever was happening to him, whatever they were doing. He closed his eyes and tried to remember how he had gotten to this place, what events led up to this imprisonment. But his short-term memory was a blank. What then was his last memory? He struggled to find it. But there was nothing, just a long, black road going back as far as his memory would travel.
"We're here to help you," Diogenes added.
Pendergast opened his eyes and stared into the heterochromic eyes of his brother. "You help me. You're my worst enemy. And besides, you're not here. You're dead." How did he know his brother was dead? If he couldn't remember, how could he be sure? And yet, he was sure. Wasn't he? "No, Aloysius," Diogenes said with a smile. "That's all part of your fantasy, your illness. Think back on your life, or what you believe has been your life. What is your profession?" Pendergast hesitated. "I'm an FBI agent." Another gentle smile.
"Okay. Now, think about that. We know all about this life of yours. You've spent the last months talking about it with Dr. Augustine. We've heard all about the insane exploits, the wild encounters. We've heard about all the people you've supposedly killed, about your narrow escapes. We've heard about genetic monsters eating people's brains and infantile serial killers living in caves. We've heard about underground mutant armies and Nazi breeding programs. We've heard about a certain young lady who is 140 years old. That, Aloysius, is the fantasy world you're finally awakening from. We're real. That crazy world is not."
As Diogenes rattled these items off, each one suddenly resonated in Pendergast's memory, bursting like a firework.
"No," he said. "It's exactly the opposite. You're twisting everything. You're not real. That other world is real."
Helen leaned over, her violet eyes looking into his. "Do you really think the FBI, the button-down FBI, would allow one of its agents to run amok, killing people willy-nilly?" She spoke calmly, her voice cool and rational. "How could all that be real? Think back on these so-called adventures of yours. Could one man, one person, really experience all that and live through it?" Diogenes spoke again, his buttery southern accent like a bomb. "You simply couldn't have survived all the adventures you've told Dr. Augustine about. Don't you see? Your memories are lying to you, not us." "Then why am I restrained? Why the hood?"
"When the breakthrough came," said Diogenes, "when Dr. Augustine finally breached the hard shell of your fantasies, you became disturbed. We had no choice but to have you restrained for your own safety. They hooded you because the light was bothering you. You've always had an aversion to light, ever since you were a child. And why the shaved head? That's necessary for the treatment, the placement of electrodes, electrical stimulation of the brain. Electrodes? What in God's name is being done to me?
Try to relax, Aloysius, Helen said soothingly. We know how difficult this must be. You're awakening from a long, long nightmare. We're here to help you back to reality. Try to sit up. Have a drink of water. Pendergast sat up, and Helen adjusted the pillows behind him. He now took a closer look at the room. It was elegant, paneled in oak, with leaded glass windows opening to a sweep of green lawn and flowering dogwood trees. He noted that the windows were discreetly barred. A Persian rug covered much of the gleaming parquet floor. The only indication that this was a hospital room was an odd-looking medical instrument set into the wall by the head of his bed, with dials, tiny lights, and a series of electrodes dangling on long, colored leads. His gaze was arrested by a strange sight. In a satin wing chair in the far corner sat a ventriloquist's dummy. The dummy had brown hair and scarlet lips. It was wearing a doctor's white coat with a stethoscope draped around its neck. Its mouth hung open, revealing a dark hole. Its glassy blue eyes, underneath arched eyebrows, stared directly at him, unblinking. It sat up very straight, its legs sticking straight out, its polished brown shoes decorated with painted orange laces. At that moment, the door opened, and a man strode in. A big, cheerful fellow with a fringe of hair around a bald pate. He was dressed in a blue serge suit with a red bow tie, a red carnation in his boutonniere. He carried a clipboard. Diogenes rose and extended his hand. "Hello, doctor. We're so glad you're here. He's awake, and I dare say a lot more lucid than before."
"Excellent," said the doctor, turning to Pendergast. "I think we've achieved a real breakthrough here."
"Breakthrough? Not at all. This is some sort of induced hallucination, some scheme to affect my sanity."
"That," said the doctor, "is the last gasp of your delusion talking. But that's quite all right. May I?"
He indicated a seat next to the ventriloquist's dummy.
"I am perfectly indifferent to your comfort," said Pendergast. "Do as you wish."
The doctor sat down, unperturbed.
"I'm so glad to see you able to recognize Helen and Diogenes. That in itself is a huge step. Before, you couldn't even see them. So powerful were your fantasies of their being dead. Now, if I may, I'd like to explain all this to you while you're lucid."
Pendergast waved a hand.
"Yours is a deep and complex case, perhaps the most complex in my experience. What I am now summarizing is the result of months of painstaking reconstruction. During your time in the Special Forces, 20 years ago, you suffered an unbearably traumatic experience. We've covered that thoroughly and don't need to touch on it again. Suffice it to say, the experience was so dreadful, it presented a threat to your sanity. Indeed, to your very existence. You left the Special Forces, but the trauma produced in you an extreme form of PTSD. Which lay deeply buried and untreated. Like a cancer, it worked away on you over the years. Being a man of means, you could afford not to work, and enforced idleness may have been the worst thing for you. You became delusional. Your primary way of dealing with this untreated PTSD was to become, in your own mind, an all-powerful FBI agent who rights wrongs, kills without mercy, and rids the world of evil. This fantasy took over your very existence.
Pendergast stared at the doctor. As much as he wanted to disbelieve, there was a disturbing logic to it. As proof, here were Diogenes and Helen, two people he'd believed dead, in the room, living, breathing, and to all his senses, absolutely real. He couldn't deny the reality of his own eyes, and yet his memories of his FBI days, which the earlier litany of Diogenes had opened to him as if by a floodgate, were just as strong.
"You've been in a dark place," the doctor said, tapping his pen on the clipboard. "But you're making real progress at last, thanks to my course of treatment. In fact, things were looking so promising that last week I brought in the two people who care about you the most, your brother and your ex-wife, to be by your side. It's always darkest just before you emerge from the tunnel."
"What is this place?"
"This is the Stony Mountain Sanatorium, outside of Saranac Lake in upstate New York."
"And how did I get here?"
"Your housekeeper found you barricaded in your Dakota apartment, raving about Nazis. The police were called. Your brother was notified, and he and your ex-wife arranged to bring you here. That was almost 6 months ago. It was slow, difficult going at first, but the progress you've made recently is most encouraging. Now, after what I've just explained, how do you feel?" Pendergast turned to Diogenes and was again struck by the look of brotherly concern on his face.
"But you made it your life's work to destroy me."
An expression of distress crossed Diogenes' face.
"That, Aloysius, is the most painful part of your delusions. I've never been anything to you but a loving brother. Sure, we had our differences as kids, what brothers don't. But to see those childish tiffs grow into this adult paranoia was really painful. But I love you, brother, and I long ago realized it was an illness, not a choice."
Pendergast turned to Helen. "And you?" She lowered her eyes.
"First, it was your fantasy about me being killed by a lion in Africa, and then your delusion morphed into something even more bizarre, that I hadn't been killed by a lion at all, but by Nazis in Mexico. There came a time when I just couldn't take it. That's why I divorced you. I'm so sorry. Maybe I should have been stronger. But the fact is, I never stopped loving you."
There was a silence. Pendergast looked around the room.
It was all so real, so vivid, and so calming. Despite himself, he felt a sense of release, as if a long nightmare was finally ending. What if they were telling the truth? If so, the horror of Helen's death hadn't happened. It was all in his mind. And how wonderful to be released from those dreadful memories, that crushing sense of guilt, pain, and remorse, free of all the horrible things he had witnessed as an FBI agent. And he could let go of the pain of Diogenes' insanity and implacable hatred. "How do you feel?" Dr. Augustine had asked. He felt at peace. He could forget everything now. It was as if all the shackles of his old false memories, his old imagined actions, were dropping away, and he was being given a second chance in life.
I think I would like to sleep now, he said.
He awoke in the dark. It was night. He sat up and saw Helen sitting in a chair near the bed, dozing. She awoke, her eyes opening, and smiled. She glanced at her watch. The moonlight was lighting up the lace curtains in the window, casting an ethereal glow over the polished oak walls. The chair with the dummy was now empty.
What time is it?
1 o'clock. He felt strangely refreshed, alert. Would you like me to turn on a light? She asked.
No, please. I like the moonlight. Do you remember the full moon?
Oh, yes, she said. Of course, the moon.
Pendergast was shaken.
He felt a sudden sense of gratitude that she was alive, that she had not died, that he was not responsible.
What I mean, if I haven't been in the FBI, what have I been doing?
Well, we met after you left the Special Forces. You never talked about it, and I never wanted to pry. You were living a life of leisure, an intellectual pursuit at the old family estate down in Louisiana, and we spent quite a few idyllic years there, as well as traveling the world, Tibet, Nepal, Brazil, Africa.
Africa.
Big game hunting. I was never killed by a lion, however. She smiled thinly. Let me just say this, Aloysius. Let me get this off my chest. I'm not proud of myself for leaving you, but I began to fear for my safety. Living with you became increasingly dangerous. Through it all, Diogenes was a saint. He learned of this experimental treatment here at Stony Mountain. It was our last option.
Pendergast nodded slowly. What will become of me now?
I'm told the recovery will take time. You'll have to stay here until the doctor feels it's complete. It might be another 6 months.
You mean I can't leave?
Helen hesitated. You'll have to face the fact that you've been legally committed, but it's for your own good. After all, it took you years and years to develop these delusions. You can't expect to get well overnight. In time, you'll be able to return to Penumbra and pick up your old life of leisure.
She took both his hands in hers.
After that, who knows what might happen? Maybe there's even hope for us. She squeezed his hands.
He returned the pressure.
She smiled, stood up. I'll come see you tomorrow, around noon.
Pendergast watched her go. A long moment passed as he fell deep into thought. For a very long time, the room was utterly silent. A strip of moonlight marched slowly across the floor.
Finally, perhaps 2 hours later, he rose from the bed. On the far side of the room was a heavy metal locker, no doubt added at the time the space was converted into a hospital room. It was secured with a padlock. He looked about. On a table in one corner sat some papers. He flipped through them, but they were only newsletters and hospital menus.